Hello, wet bandits and big mistakes, huge and all the ships at sea, and welcome to A Very Good Year, the movie podcast where we invite a guest to pick their favorite year of movies and talk to us about that year. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today is the editorial director at IndieWire, where she oversees and manages the site's film, TV, awards, and craft features teams, and writes and edits as well. She's been at IndieWire since 2015. Before that, her byline appeared at Vanity Fair, Cosmopolitan, Rolling Stone, The Dissolve, Vulture, and more. She's a member of the New York Film Critics Circle and the Critics' Choice Association, and also she is just a wonderful human being. Say hi to Kate Erbland. Hey, Kate.
Jason, how do I, like, what do you say to that? Like, yes, I am a wonderful human being.
Thank you. Well, I so mean, you've worked, I feel like, to, I mean, it's an earned reputation. I feel like you can own it. This will air a little later, but we're speaking in late March, which was kind of the first chance we had to talk coming off the Oscars before we get into Cannes. As editorial director for a site like IndieWire, I would imagine this is one of the few semi-sorta lulls in your calendar, yes?
Well, today is March 27th, and today we literally posted our Cannes wish list, which is 30 films that not only do we hope are going to be at Cannes, but we have some intel that maybe they will be. So even with Cannes, like 2 months off, that's still on the mind. We're talking about Emmys already. So this is a very, very brief respite before getting back into it. There's no more lulls like there used to be. Summer used to be a lull. Not anymore.
Nope. No, they move festivals around. Things are always, there's always some nonsense.
Did you know that Tribeca this year is in the middle of June? I didn't know that.
They'll settle on a date eventually, I'm sure. But I'm glad we got you. What year did you pick for our little talk and why?
I picked 1990. I think probably the reason I picked 1990 is because it is home to one of my all-time top five favorite films, which is Pretty Woman. So I think one thing that'll probably come up a lot when we talk about the movies on this episode, you'll hear about me. I was 7 years old for most of 1990. I am an only child. I come from a family where my parents let me watch all kinds of things when I shouldn't have.
I came
from a very small town where we had a one screen movie theater. So when we go to the movies, it was whatever was playing. So some of my choices are not quite appropriate for a 6 or 7 year old, but they were for me. And they've really stuck with me. And I think 1990 is one of those years. And just like looking at, you know, all the other options, I was like, oh, yeah, this was a pretty big year for me and a pretty big go to the theater year.
Right. And all movies that made quite an impact at the theater as well. And so,
yeah, that actually shines an interesting light on your choices, like the sort of what's available in a small market, et cetera. Conversations Jason and I have had relating to guests several times over the course of this show. You know, like I didn't get to see lots of things until they were on the internet. That's interesting. That's good to know.
Yeah. I spent some time in my youth in an even smaller market of McPherson, Kansas, that had this same thing, the single screen movie theater that showed one new movie every week. And it was a good, at least 3-4 weeks after it had played, you know, the nearest major market.
So you're going to get the ones that are selling.
Yep.
Yes. You know? Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, when I was looking at my choices, I noticed, like, I mean, we're going to obviously talk more about them specifically. I won't name names yet. Of my five I included, it's the 1, 2, 3 highest earners of the year. There's number 7.
Right.
The lowest one was number 17. So I was like, yeah. We got like the top 20 movies, I think, in Manchester, Vermont. That's what we were getting.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I mean, it established you're a populist, Kate, and that was born out of this era, I would imagine. Where did you, because I don't actually know your origin story, how did that blossom into, you know, sort of the full scale cinephiliac that you are today?
Okay, so it's the first 8 years of my life in a small town going to a one screen movie theater. Then we moved to Las Vegas, and it was a big change. For most of the time we were in Las Vegas, I was a latchkey kid, and so I watched a lot of HBO, TBS, TNT, all that stuff after school. And, you know, again, my parents, not a lot of limits, and when they weren't there, no limits whatsoever. And then when I went to college, I went to Loyola Marymount in LA. I was not a film student. They have a wonderful film school. Many of my friends were film students. I took like the film 101 classes where I was like, oh, I'm learning about the history of film and like catching up on the classics. I wrote for the college newspaper and I just always really loved movies, which I know you guys feel the same way and you probably feel the same way I do, which is sometimes you say that to people and they don't feel that way. And you're just right. Like, who are you? So
how does that work?
How does that? What were you doing as a child? I guess you were playing outside. I don't know. Couldn't be me. And so, yeah, it was just like I was an English major with an art history minor. So I loved criticism and appreciating art and thinking about art, talking about art. I started movie blogging when I was like 23 and just kind of went from there.
And here you are today.
Here I am today.
Congratulations.
All right. Any of this sound familiar, Jason?
Vaguely, mildly, maybe all of it. All right. Well, I am anxious to get into this this very box office friendly top five. But before we do, we're going to find out what else was going on in the world outside of the local cinema there in Manchester, Vermont. Here is Mike with headlines.
1990. The U.S. was obviously killing it on the world stage.
Sometimes literally killing it on the world.
Often literally. Former CIA employee Manuel Noriega was arrested in Panama. Some people suggest that arresting him was part of the cleanup act our intelligence agencies went on after the end of the Cold War. I have written an essay about the inherent flaws in the domino theory and the counterproductive nature of American condescension in the late stages of the 20th century. It should only take me about a half an hour. Everybody here for that? We got time?
Yeah, let's go. Here we okay. go.
I'm all ready. Right. I want it.
Actually, you know what? That'll be a bonus episode. There we go.
There you go. There you go. On February 11, Nelson Mandela was released after 27 years in prison. That seemed like a better late than never situation.
No. Yes. Correct. Correct. An unalloyed good. Yes.
Here's a bit of news I found. April 26, Danny Wood of the seminal boy band New Kids on the Block stepped on a stuffed animal and twisted his ankle. That's how fucking famous they were. I don't actually care about the news story. I want you to know that's how famous New Kids on the Block were. That information is still available to people. I do some digging around for these segments, but I'm not like buying old copies of Teen Beat off eBay for Christopher's sake. Like, I just found that on the internet today.
Yay.
That's ridiculous. I hate it. Anyway, I'm clearly still hurt by whatever that was.
New Kids. Kate, did you enjoy the New Kids circa 1990?
I was a little young for the New Kids. I was into the Backstreet Boys a couple years later. But the New Kids kind of missed me a little bit.
All right. Makes sense. It's of a similar vintage. It's a similar flavor.
Oof. Some Supreme Court news, also in April, they ruled that states could make it a crime to possess or look at kiddie porn, even if you're like in your own home. That could still be illegal. Yeah. They didn't outlaw sodomy laws until 2003, but we were still having this conversation in 1990. Ugh.
Okay. All right.
Awful. In June, the Supreme Court declared flag burning legal, so you can go do that if you don't like having friends. Here's a stat. You ready? 99% of U.S. households in 1990 had at least one radio, with the average household owning five radios per house.
Holy shit.
I have to assume that's clock radio alarms, right?
Sure. You can. I mean, that could, like, that's part of the countdown. Have one? Yes. Yeah. Yes, of course.
What do you suppose that number is now? Like 9%?
When was the last time you even listened to the radio? Like, real talk.
Ooh, I charged my phone the last time the electricity went out, so like not even then.
Okay, sounds good. Makes sense.
The Simpsons, Seinfeld, and Entertainment Weekly debuted in 1990. That feels like a 1990 thing to say. Yeah.
Yeah.
John Updike's Rabbit at Rest brought an underwhelming end to an underwhelming series. Fuck those books. Don't read them. Don't let people.
Shots fired at Updike.
Don't let people tell you they're good.
The Hubble. Wait till LitHub hears about this. We're gonna get some hate clicks.
He had one fantastic quote about living in New York. I don't know about the rest of it. The Hubble Space Telescope was launched in 1990, so that's cool. Fancy fake photos to make us think we're not living in a simulation.
Okay. All right.
One awful bit of sports news. I'm going to keep the sports news short. Brian Holman of the Oakland A's pitched 8 2/3 of a perfect game. And for all of you who don't know what that means that he didn't allow a hit in the entire game. He had one batter left to get out, and he would pitch a perfect game, which is a rare event in baseball. Mr. Ken Phillips, who hit a home run. Ouch. Mm-hmm. Ooh. Fuck you, Brian Holman. Go home. Nobody cares.
Missed it by that much.
That much. In December, NASA was the source of a headline that feels like trolling, to be honest. In big, bold letters, the papers told us NASA discovers life, on Earth. Fuck you guys. That's so rude.
Yeah.
It turns out they were testing the spacecraft Galileo's instrument array. That particular array is designed to detect life on other planets, so they were using us as a control group to test it.
I see.
It made sense.
Very clever, nerds. Yeah.
Yeah, very clever.
Somebody needed to pants those guys.
And finally, I'm going to do a very indulgent self-referential headline shout out to season one. There was a World Cup in 1990. West Germany won in what would be their final appearance in any global tournament because East and West Germany were reunited a few months later. And if you'd like to hear me be very excited about that, you can listen to our previous 1990 episode because I went in. That's headlines.
Thank you, Mike. Kate Erbland, you ready to do a top five?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so we have decided to do a ranked list. These are the films in their order of importance to Kate, landing at the most important, which, spoiler, she mentioned in the opening segment. But going back, what is the number five movie on your top five for 1990?
The number five movie, and I think I actually sort of surprised myself when I was reviewing some notes before. It's Kevin Costner's Dances with Wolves.
In a wild and unknown land, she taught him the language of a noble people. With courage and passion, their love grows stronger.
My place is with you.
But with the threat of a hostile world, it may never survive.
I'll catch up.
Kevin Costner, Dances with Wolves, rated PG-13, now playing in select cities, opens November 21st everywhere.
I don't know why I picked this, except it's like seared in my brain as, I can't even say it's like the first epic that I was really into as a kid, because the first epic I was really into as a kid was the miniseries The Thornbirds, which my mom...
Oh, God.
Yes. So,
Kate,
I know. I think kids are learning a lot about me.
Woo!
My mom was super into the Thornbirds, and they used to like rerun it on CBS every couple of years or something, and we watched the whole thing. So I think
when you were six,
I think I was like 6 or 7 the first time I saw it, and it.
Okay.
I mean,
that's. That'll imprint.
I have feelings about Richard Chamberlain that no one else in our generation has. But I do think it gave me an early taste for long epics, beautiful sweeping vistas, people falling in love with the wrong people, men in the wrong place, literally, figuratively. And I've always had a real soft spot for Kevin Costner. I think it came from this. I assume that my parents rented it and we watched it a couple years later. This was definitely not an in-theater experience.
Right. And this was a two-tape VHS experience.
Yes, it was one of those. Just also like Titanic. But it just sort of, it was beautiful and it stuck with me. And I think it was one of these movies that the more I grew up and I learned more about it, like, it's his first film. It just like, it really, there's a lot to appreciate about it. I think, you know, thinking about something, you know, last year, like Killers of the Flower Moon, I think, hey, you know, maybe centering a white guy isn't the best thing, but I think Costner did a really good job. I believe that like the Lakota Nation have lauded him for the work that he did. And I think that even as a kid, you realize there's a level of authenticity and care in what you're seeing. And when it's so obvious on the screen, you can't help but notice it. I was also someone who was really obsessed with Little House on the Prairie. So anything that had any kind of pioneer thing, I was very much in the bag for. So
this first segment is deliciously all over the place.
I feel like I'm like talking through it right now. Like I'm just like
that's great.
I love it.
So those are my Dances with Wolves thoughts.
Yeah.
Oh, and I'm a huge animal lover.
That helps too. I have a complicated history with Dance with Wolves because I was old enough to see it when it came out in the theater. I remember going to Cinemas East and seeing it. That's the exact wrong age to see it. Like I had just turned 15 at Christmas 1990. Like talk about not. It's just boring. I didn't understand the historical significance. I didn't like Westerns yet. You know, I was still a few years from liking Westerns. And then, you know, 3 months later, 2 months later, however long it was, it beats Goodfellas for Best Picture and Best Director. And I was enough of a teen movie nerd to have to have the righteous indignation over that injustice. You know, they picked that boring movie, you know, and it's a grudge I've held for quite some time. I'll admit it. I went back and rewatched Dances with Wolves for the first time since 1990 last weekend in preparation for this show. And you know what? It's a good movie. It's a good movie. I've seen many more Westerns, both, you know, sort of traditional and subversive. I have a much fuller appreciation of what a sort of radical act it is to treat Indigenous characters with the respect that this movie does. I have a fuller appreciation for Kevin Costner as a director, mostly from Open Range, which is a movie I think has been weirdly sort of memory hold, but was his sort of comeback after The Postman. And we don't have to, like, the less said about The Postman, the better. But that was him sort of back to his roots already in 2001 doing a frontier Western that's really magnificent. And it's also a very fine performance. Like this is what Kevin Costner could do in your movie in 1990, kind of better than anybody else. Like he really was the sort of Gary Cooper for that era in a way that we haven't had since. Is this one that you have revisited frequently since then?
It was on TV maybe a year ago and I watched like the last hour and it really, it still stuck with me. And I think obviously Costner is someone who at that time we realized had a real interest and maybe even obsession with the American West. He has only continued to do that in other different ways. But this to me, I think is my favorite example of that interest and obsession. Haven't been watching the TV shows.
This movie had to go to HBO, right?
Oh God, they wore it out. It was an HBO mainstay.
In 1990, it felt like this was the only movie that came out in 1990. But by the time it made it to HBO, I don't remember how long sort of later it was, but I just remember my dad watched it every time they played it. And it seems like that was a lot.
Yeah, it sure was
a lot. And I just remember sort of making some sort of comment about it. I don't even know what stupid thing I said. And him just sort of being like, all right, you say so. You know, just having that like very like sort of parent sort of like whatever the fuck, boy, you know, having that very sort of parental sort of reaction to it. You know?
Yeah, I remember.
And then
that
eventually
one.
I watched it with him. You know, eventually at some point it was on and he watched it every time. So I sat down and watched it and it turns out it's a good movie, you know.
Yeah.
I just needed his little bit of like, you know, calm it down sort of dad energy to sit down for 5 minutes, you know.
It is a very dad energy movie. All right, Kate, what then is the number four movie on your top five for 90?
The number four movie I definitely saw in theaters because I remember my favorite line specifically. It is Die Hard 2.
Your wife's plane? They're going to run out of fuel in 90 minutes.
L.A. cop John McClane is back.
What are you going to do?
Whatever I can.
Because old habits die hard.
We are just up to our neck in terrorists again, John.
On July 4th, Die Harder. Bruce Willis, Die Hard 2, rated R.
I had not seen Die Hard 1 at that point. I would say at this point in my life, I have still seen Die Hard 2 more than any of the other Die Hards. Die Hard is like second in that.
Wow.
Everybody has a sequel that they had on VHS.
Yeah.
This one, what I specifically remember in the theater laughing so hard is there is a scene where Bruce Willis, as John McClane, is like tangled up in a parachute. And he says, "Where's the fucking door?" And as a 7-year-old, I thought that was the funniest thing I had ever heard in my life, to the point that I think my mom like put her hand over my mouth because I was laughing too hard. And she was just like, "We're going to see someone we know. Stop."
It's a very 7-year-old friendly joke. It's true. Like, props to them.
But it just like, it was, it's one of these things where when I have gone back and watched it many, many times, like at least once a year, probably when it's on TV. Obviously, we are a household that still reveres when things are on HBO or TBS or TNT. It's still like, it's just such a great action movie. And Bruce Willis will always be such a great action star. John McClane is somehow like a Superman and hugely relatable. Like, he can't get out of a parachute, but he, you know, continues to save the world all the time. And I think I just loved it. I think it's great. I think it holds up. I think at the time I knew I was probably always going to love it. And I think it was probably like the first big action movie that I did see in the theater. And for all of those reasons, it has stuck with me. It's held up. I feel an immense sense of pride about seeing it as a kid and still loving it now.
Yeah, it's wild because there is a, I've encountered people online who really ding this one, who really think this one is far inferior to the first or the third one. And I just don't see it. I think it's, especially if you double them up, like sometimes, you know, come Christmas, we'll do the Die Hard 1 and 2 double feature. Like, they work so beautifully together because it is, honestly, it's the only one that really feels like an actual sequel to Die Hard, in that it's got not just him, but several of the other players from the first movie in it. And all of the other ones tend to be just like Bruce Willis as whatever version of the character we're doing this time and a bunch of other new people. So I've always liked that about it. I've always liked the continuity of it. I think it's got some really terrific action beats. I think Renny Harlin certainly didn't have a career noted for the longevity of the quality pictures. But when he was on at this moment, he was really on.
I'll give you some fresh eyes. I'd never seen it before. I thought I had. I put it on like, oh, I've obviously seen this. I'll do a rewatch. Turns out I had never seen it before. This movie's fucking great. I've seen the first one 50 times. So, like, you know, there's no way I had never seen the second one. But I didn't even know there was a third one, I guess. I don't know. Maybe I haven't.
It's good.
But I had never seen it before. This movie's great. I really enjoyed it, and it makes perfect sense as a follow-up. Like, and it's one of those things where it's like, what complaints are there to have? What do you want out of a fucking Die Hard movie? There's snowmobiles. It's there great, are. Dude.
The bad guys hang out in a church. Like, come on.
It's got William Sadler. Like, the first time you see him doing, like, nude stretching, I'm like, what? That's a new introduction. Folks, this movie has Franco fucking Nero in it. Like, Django is the object of all, you know, is the object of the action. Like, it's a terrific, fun picture. And the shot, and it was in the trailers. Like, so I even remember, like, I knew this was coming and it still, like, pulled me out of my seat. The shot, the overhead shot when he ejects out of the plane when it explodes and comes like nose to the lens and then goes back down to the runway before your favorite line about the parachute. That's just great 90s action movie making. I'm sorry. It just is.
It's absolutely ridiculous and it's perfect. And I don't know what else you want from it. Anyway, great movie. This is the only one I had never seen before. And like I said, of course I thought I had. Yeah, but no, it turns out there's a shootout on fucking snowmobiles. I would have remembered that.
I mean, Mike, what a treat for you.
I would have remembered that.
This is like an undiscovered Die Hard movie for you. I'm like, I'm so pleased. I'm like really delighted about this.
I appreciate it. The fucking door line is fantastic, even at 47.
There you go. All right, Kate, what is the number three movie on your top five for 1990?
I mean, the number three movie is a movie that has to be included by anyone who is a child during this time, which is, of course, yes. Home Alone.
In their rush to the airport, the McAllisters overlooked one minor detail. Now, his parents have a problem.
I don't care if I have to get out on your runway and hitchhike. I am going to get home to my son.
Two burglars are in trouble.
We know that you're in there.
And Kevin is in heaven. Home Alone. Rated PG. Starts Friday at theaters everywhere.
Mm-hmm. I mean, another film that I think holds up. I don't think any of the sequels do, especially the one with Donald Trump. But
nope,
for another year. It's just like, you know, Home Alone, it's clever and it's really mean and it's really funny. And Macaulay Culkin is just, you know, one of these child stars who is somehow precocious in a way that you didn't want to slap him in the face, which mm-hmm. is not usually the case with child stars. And, you know, it's a Christmas classic. It's one of these things. Again, when it's on cable, we'll watch it. You'll watch it again. I think Catherine O'Hara is wonderful in it. I love seeing...
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Would this have been your introduction to Ms. O'Hara's work?
I think it must have been. And I love John Candy in this, even though we don't get a lot of him. And obviously, like, I can't remember a time when I didn't love John Candy. And so I think the older you get and the more times you watch it, you know, you are stopped. You're not as invested in Kevin and you're more worried about his mom and her, like, just wrenching desperation to get back to him and, like, giving those horrible old people, like, all of her jewelry and the plane tickets and just everything and them just, like, taking more and more and more. It makes me angry now. And as a kid, you think it's so funny and you're just like, oh, Kevin's mom, she's just so bad at this. And I think that there's a lot of, like, there's real pathos there. And I love it, and I hope it's something. I know that there have been sort of like requel attempts, but it to me it's sort of like an unimpeachable classic, no matter what the year.
Yeah, I would agree with that. This one I rewatched about a year and a half ago, because I was researching a book that we have mentioned on this show a couple of times, a John Candy biography that fell apart. But this is actually one of my favorite little tidbits about this movie in relation to him is that, you know, he did it as a favor to John Hughes. John Hughes was writing and producing. He had turned it over to Chris Columbus to direct, but it was through Hughes's, you know, burgeoning production company. He had, of course, written and directed Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and Uncle Buck for John Candy. They'd worked together on The Great Outdoors, on Vacation. They had this collaboration. And so John Hughes asked John Candy as a favor to come do this little cameo. They only had one day with him, so they shot for almost 24 hours straight to get all of his scenes. He only took the SAG minimum for that day's work. That's it. John Hughes offered him 1% of the gross because he could only pay him the SAG minimum. And John Candy turned it down. He said, I am doing this as a favor to a friend. You'll do a favor for me down the line. It's fine. And it became the highest grossing comedy ever made to that time. Over $500 million total worldwide box office. If he had taken that point, he would have made $5 million for one day's work. But he didn't. So he was able to use that leverage along with Chris Columbus's cachet after this to make another movie for Fox the following year called Only the Lonely, which is a really terrific picture that Columbus wrote and directed and John Hughes produced and John Candy starred in. That is my John Candy Home Alone story. Ta-da! And then, of course, the other thing I found out was just that he wrote this expressly for Macaulay Culkin after they shot Uncle Buck. That he thought this kid was so talented and so could carry a movie on his own. And so he wrote it specifically as a Macaulay Culkin vehicle. That's kind of as good as it got for little Macaulay. That's it's a strange career and sort of a a very sad story of parental exploitation and all sorts of oogie shit like that. But they seem to have come out okay, those Gokin boys.
I was going to say, it feels like they've pulled it together.
They have. Yeah. They have. I have shown this movie to one of my children. I've shown it to my older child, who I think will not replicate the slapsticky.
It's just giving ideas to the younger one, bro. I'm in the exact same situation. The younger one's going to hit me in the face with a fucking bucket. Like, I can't do it. I'm smarter than that. I see her coming.
No, thank you. No, you just the mature one gets to watch Home Alone for now. All right, Kate, what then is the number two movie, the second best movie of 1990 for little Kate Erbland?
So it's the number two movie. It was the number one box office hit of the year, which is insane.
As we say farewell to our friend, Sam Wheat.
It's like I can still feel you.
If you can't believe what you hear.
I get a message from Sam.
Sam's dead.
What you see.
Sam was not just accidentally killed.
I was murdered. Then trust what you feel.
I'd give anything if I could just touch you once more.
You will believe. Ghost. Rated PG-13. Now playing at theaters everywhere.
And so the reason why I've picked Ghost is... originally, when Jason finally asked me to be on the podcast, he gave me some various years to pick from. And one of my other choices was 1987 for Dirty Dancing, which apparently had already, the year had been taken. It's fine. So I guess we're going pretty deep on young Kate psyche.
Yeah.
Dirty Dancing and Pretty Woman are my two favorite movies. Definitely saw them too young. But Patrick Swayze... in Dirty Dancing.
Yeah. Handsome man.
Imprinted on me. So I definitely made my parents take me to see Ghost in the theater because I had such a raging Patrick Swayze crush. And again, no limits with those two. And I remember liking it. I remember being incredibly scared because it is a scary movie. I hadn't revisited it for a long time. One thing that my boyfriend, the great Mike Ryan, and I did during the early days of lockdown, we have a two-bedroom apartment in Manhattan. Our second larger bedroom is our screening room. We have a 90-inch projector screen, and we started showing people in our bubble canon films that they had not seen. And one of the movies that we've shown people the most is Ghost. A lot of people had a weird understanding of what it was. I think a lot of people think of the pottery scene. They just think it's like a weird, sexy romance. And it's like, no, this movie is everything. It is.
It is.
Yeah. It's funny. It's scary. It's sexy.
Maybe the best New York subway scene in the 90s.
Ever.
In movies. I mean.
Vincent Schiavelli, RIP. Yeah.
It's Whoopi Goldberg is, she's incredible in it. She won an Oscar for it. It's very deserved. It's a movie that has everything in a way that even the great movies these days don't. It is every genre. It hits every beat. And by the end of it, no matter how many times I've seen it, how many times we've shown it to people, everyone is sobbing. Like, I get misty thinking about it. It is a beautiful, wonderful, unimpeachable film. And the fact that it was number one at the box office in 1990 is insane to me. Nothing like that will ever happen again, but I'm happy it happened then.
I mean, there are so many insane things about this movie. Like, the director of Ghost is Jerry Zucker, who was one of the three guys behind Airplane and Top Secret and The Naked Gun. Like, how you get from Airplane and Top Secret and The Naked Gun to Ghost, I'm not sure where one skill set feeds into the other. He does them both very well.
Deep emotion. Deep emotions. Yes. Deeply human feelings.
Sure.
Gotta be smart to be funny, right?
It's very true.
At least on purpose.
The screenwriter is Bruce Joel Rubin, who also penned Jacob's Ladder in 1990. I'm assuming that one you did not see at age seven, Kate.
No, I did not.
Okay. There were some boundaries. And then 2-3 years later, he wrote and directed My Life with Michael Keaton and Nicole Kidman, and then just kind of disappeared. But it's a strange script, but it works. The players are all well cast. I rewatched this one when I was writing the New York book because you know what? It's kind of about gentrification. It is a snapshot of New York in the late '80s, early '90s when a couple was taking a sledgehammer to an apartment and turning it into something special for themselves. That was happening a lot. Yeah, it's a lot of fun and yes, an Oscar winner as well. Mike, where had you seen Ghost before? I assume.
Oh yeah, dude. I dated girls in the 1990s. yeah, I had definitely seen Ghost, and you know, it's one of those ones. I know I've said this before that you sit down reluctantly to watch with some girl because whatever, that's what mm-hmm. she wants to do, and what you want to do is just be there right. for whenever the movie's over, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's just like Dances with Wolves, where it's just like, you know, I'm just like a bitchy kid with a bad attitude until somebody's like, shut up. And you actually do that for 5 minutes. And it turns out it's a great movie. And yeah. by the way, you know, you can make all the Saturday Night Live sketches and fucking memes and GIFs out of that, you know, that pottery scene that you want in context. That shit is hot as fuck. Like,
it's hot and sad.
It's hot and sad and like, right. And this is one of those things where, you know, I don't know when the last time I saw it was, but if I wasn't, I think I was married. If I wasn't married yet, I was definitely like with my wife, the person I'm married to now, you know?
Yeah.
And that scene does take on a completely different thing when you actually have somebody that you like unironically expect to be with for the rest of your life. And that yeah. sort of idea that could just not happen one day, you mm. know, and of course, in the movie, it's behind some bullshit and it's this, you know, you got a bad guy and it's a movie scenario. But it's very obvious that it doesn't require a villain yeah. and bank fraud to lose your significant other. Right. So like it really does take on a completely different sort of thing. And that whole scene. You know, holy shit. I mean, yeah. And this has been something that we've talked about. There's a lot of movies that you and I saw when we were kids that we just never talked about again for whatever reason, you know, mm-hmm. and we've had sort of these discoveries repeatedly where it's like being an adult, being married, having kids, like you're watching a movie and it's just like, we talked about that with The Sopranos. The first time I watched it, I was much closer to AJ than Tony. And mm-hmm. watching it this, you know, watching it again, you're just sort of like, I don't relate to AJ at all, but I'm trying hard to figure out what the fuck I'm going to do when my kids go off that deep end, right? And Ghost, I think, is a similar sort of thing. Yeah. Everything about it that you can sort of make fun of for whatever reason you want takes on a whole other universe now. Good movie.
Yeah. All right.
And that goddamn subway scene, which was great when I was a teenager and remains so.
That's true. Very true. All right, that brings us to the peak. That brings us to the number one, which, I mean, we've mentioned it a few times now, but Kate, what is the number one for 90?
It's Gary Marshall's Pretty Woman.
From Touchstone Pictures, he's rich and powerful.
That's my confidence.
She's anything but.
I kind of fly by the seat of my pants, gal.
And they're getting together in Beverly Hills.
Nobody get in trouble bringing me in here.
Now their lives.
Slipped little suckers.
And that city.
Give it your gum.
Will never be the same again.
Come and be happy. There's a sofa in here for two.
Close your mouth, dear.
Richard Gere, Julia Roberts. Pretty Woman, rated R. Starts Friday at a theater near you. Mercy.
As it says on my Letterboxd profile, I'm a Pretty Woman scholar. This was probably like the first movie that I remember distinctly hearing at some point when I was a teenager, like, oh yeah, like the script was originally a lot darker and they didn't end up together. And I was like, wait, what? And so many, many years later, I did a story on it for Vanity Fair where I basically called up Jonathan Lawton, the screenwriter, and he pretty much just answered the phone and told me whatever I wanted to hear. And it's all about, you know, it was a script that was in the Sundance Labs. It was much darker. They didn't end up together. But what I love talking to him, hearing is how excited he was where it did go. It's a touchstone film directed by Gary Marshall, starring America's sweetheart, Julia Roberts, before she was America's sweetheart, the film that made her America's sweetheart. And he's pleased where it went. Of course, it made like a ton of money and it's hugely popular.
It's bought him houses in 7 countries, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure.
He shouldn't be excited, but he doesn't have any of this like, oh, I wish we had done my original vision. He's not caught up in that because I think he loves and understands why it ended up the way it ended up. It was very similar to Dirty Dancing. It was a film I saw way too young, did not understand a lot of the darker stuff, but just found it delightful and fun and fizzy. And I have been a Julia Roberts fan almost my entire life because of this. She's so appealing. The scene where Richard Gere snaps the jewelry box on her hand, which it was something he actually he improvised, and her laugh, that like, it just, every moment to me is iconic and wonderful and fun. The fashion's great, you know, the interactions with the bitchy like store girls, big mistake, huge. It's just, you know, everyone, the kids these days overuse iconic. For me, this is like a top 2 iconic movie. If it's on TV, I'm watching it. If you haven't seen it, I don't think we can be friends. It's just, it is ingrained in me. And every time I learn more about it, I talk more to people about it, I still remain obviously extremely excited about it. And it's just, it's my number one for 1990. It's maybe my number. It's between Pretty Woman and Dirty Dancing. That's just how it is for me.
I rewatched this one the other night, and it was the first time in a few years, but it is one I've definitely seen a lot of times. And there is just something, aside from everything that's sort of that's well crafted about it, that's, you know, the writing is tight, the supporting players are impeccable. Hector Elizondo, I just want him to take care of me. There is something uniquely thrilling about watching an actor become a movie star in front of your eyes. We just a few days ago talked with Bob Byington about 1994, and we talked about Speed, and it's like the reaction the first time I saw this to Julia Roberts was very similar to when you see Sandra Bullock in Speed. I saw this movie at a sneak preview. Do you remember sneak previews, Kate? Do you remember these? Where you would go on like the Saturday before it came out and you would pay for one movie that was already in release and you would see something that was coming out again soon.
I've heard of them. I did not experience them. I've heard of.
These were a cornerstone of my teenage movie going. And in March or February, it would have been March of 1990 because the film came out on March 23rd. But a couple weeks before that, my friend Brian Hughes and I bought our tickets to Joe versus the Volcano and then stayed after for Pretty Woman, a movie we knew nothing about. We had no impression. We didn't know who Richard Gere was as, you know, 14-year-olds in 1990. And, you know, we didn't know who Julia Roberts was, but she's on the poster and she's hot. So let's go see this movie. And we were both thoroughly enchanted, cynical teenage boys, absolutely enraptured by this little Cinderella story. It's really, it's a charmer.
There had been a lot of dark movies about sex workers by 1990, lots of them. Mm-hmm. Yep. And it turns out maybe that's actually one of the things that's really interesting about this movie, is that it's not a dark movie about a sex worker. And maybe that's actually sort of part of why it has such staying power. Obviously her, obviously him, you know, obviously there's, you know, you have genuine movie stars here, and for whatever reason we give a shit about that. We certainly do with these two, you know, and they carry all of that with them. But actually, maybe we don't want to see her have some terrible fucking awful dark thing happen to her.
Crack habit. Yeah.
Dead in a dumpster.
Yeah.
Right. And that's one of those things where, like, I never would have sort of understood that as being a revolutionary element of the film in 1990. But it was clear as day.
Yeah.
You know, in 20, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Like, it was really obvious, especially because now I've seen a lot of the dark sex worker movies. And at some point you are kind of like, okay, fuck me. Like, right. Yeah. Like there's only how many sort of ways, how much sort of are we learning from watching this abuse happen again and again and again in whatever way your fetish designed.
Yeah.
You, Mr. Right. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway. Yeah. It's also, it's such a, there's so much more to say about the world around this movie than was obvious to me then, too. That I've, and most of that I've heard women say since then. And it's actually been really great and useful. You know, yeah. It's one of those things where, like, there is a perspective on this movie that sort of wasn't available. And there were women who were talking about movies then, but not the way there are now, and not with the sort of freedom to sort of pick the way they want to talk about movies and so on and so forth. I've heard a lot of women who were very young when this movie came out, who've talked about it since then and had all kinds of super smart shit to say in a way that I just am not sure that was a part of the culture.
Yeah.
Then. And it's like, it's useful sometimes to sort of look at these like watershed, these huge moments in our culture and this thing that we like, yeah, and sort of compare it to now and think about now. And like one way that movies are better now, or at least movie culture is better now, is that a lot of women can say whatever the fuck they want, enough that some of them are wrong and some of them will teach you something. And that's great, because that's how, yeah, being a people works. You know, yes. So like this movie, I've really enjoyed the discourse around this movie as much as the movie.
Yeah. Well said, sir. Kate, I have to ask as the follow-up, where do you stand on Runaway Bride, the 1999 reunion of the key players herein?
I like it. I don't love it. I don't feel the same way about it. I think it's much more predictable than anything else in Pretty Woman. It's great to see them together. They clearly have a great time together. They love each other. They respect each other. But it's no Pretty Woman.
It's PG. It's not even PG-13. It's PG. That's my main ding against Runaway Bride. All right, Kate, thank you so much for that spiffy top five. Let's find out about the big doings of the entertainment business in the year 1990. Here is Mike with the Hollywood Minute. Hollywood freaks on the Hollywood
scene. Both Oscar and Kate loved Dances with Wolves, which won trophies for Best Picture, Best Director for Kevin Costner, and Best Adapted Screenplay for Michael Blake. It beat Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas in all of those categories, and folks, read Jason Bailey, have been mad about it pretty much ever since.
Kate, where do you land on Goodfellas?
Oh, I love Goodfellas. Like, Goodfellas is incredible. Like, what are we talking about here? Come on.
Goodfellas didn't go away empty-handed, though. Mr. Joe Pesci won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, fucking right he did, and gave one of the great Oscar acceptance speeches ever, which we will play right here.
Well, it's my privilege. Thank you.
Just love a guy known for playing chatterboxes, getting up there and giving a five-word speech.
Love it.
Best actor went to Jeremy Irons for Reversal of Fortune. Best actress to Kathy Bates for Misery. And best supporting actress to Whoopi Goldberg for Ghost. I don't got a lot of to complain about here.
I was going to say, Kate, thoughts on Reversal of Fortune or Misery?
I love Misery. I don't know if I've seen Reversal of Fortune.
It is not terribly easy to see, but I finally saw it not long ago, like maybe 4 years ago. Maybe that was like a lockdown movie for me. And it's terrific. It's really well done. Jeremy Irons is fantastic, but you know, Alan Dershowitz is like the hero of that movie. So that aspect of it is
right. It's that
not aged well, not aged well at all, gang. Not a durable story point there.
That's hilarious. Home Alone also won the box office in 1990, pulling in $285 million domestic, with Ghost coming in second, Dances with Wolves in third, and Pretty Woman in fourth. Kate's got the pulse of the people in 1990, huh? Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came in fifth, banking $135 million on a $13.5 million budget, and its $25 million plus opening weekend was the biggest ever for an independent movie. Like,
yep.
Sure. I didn't think of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles as an independent movie when it came out.
Line Cinema was still an independent at that time. Yes.
Fair enough. Other big hits in 1990 include The Hunt for Red October, Total Recall, Die Hard 2, and Dick Tracy.
Kate, any other faves in there? Any others that you still like?
I definitely had like a really weird soft spot for Dick Tracy because my childhood best friend was like obsessed with Madonna.
Dick Tracy fucking rules. I love Dick Tracy. It is like better than 98% of all comic book or comic strip movies.
Yeah, that should go without saying at this point.
The 1990 Palme d'Or winner at Cannes was David Lynch's Wild at Heart. That was fucking French. While the New York Film Critics Circle and the Los Angeles Film Critics Association gave their best film award to Goodfellas, like proper Americans. One of the low-key biggest film stories of the year was the ruling against Paramount Pictures in Buchwald v. Paramount, in which humorist Art Buchwald claimed Paramount Pictures had stolen his film pitch King for a Day and turned into Eddie Murphy's 1988 hit Coming to America. While the ruling was slightly dubious, read the treatment for King for a Day if you don't believe me, the case would become an important demonstration of so-called Hollywood accounting, as Paramount would attempt to claim that Coming to America, which grossed $288 million, had also somehow not shown a profit.
Huh.
Amazing. Amazing. In 1990, that. We were graced with the entrances of Julia Fox, Margot Robbie, Isaac Gonzalez, Liam Hemsworth, Emma Watson, Dev Patel, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, Bill Skarsgård. He's got to be the lesser known Skarsgård, right? Wow. We all agree on that.
Shots Bill. Fired at the Skarsgård family.
It's like their cousin in Kentucky or something. Bowen Yang, cool. Taylor Page, and Elizabeth Debicki, who is 6'3" tall.
I just love her for that. She's 6'3" tall, and we thank her for being 6'3" tall.
Hell yeah. Tall queen. And in 1990, we said farewell to the incredible Michael Powell, the gnarly Sergio Corbucci, the exquisite Martin Ritt, the delicious Jacques Demy, the gorgeous Ava Gardner, the uproarious Robin Harris, the icon Greta Garbo, the effervescent Paulette Goddard, the iconic Sammy Davis Jr., the delightful Rex Harrison, the one and only Jim Henson, the delightful Irene Dunne, and the star of Babyface, the greatest pre-code movie ever, and the Lady Eve, maybe the greatest screwball comedy ever, Barbara Stanwyck. If we do this show for another whole season, Jason's going to have these fucking things rhyming. That's a true queen, and that's your Hollywood Minute.
Thank you, Mike. All right, Kate, you ready to do a lightning round?
Yes.
Okay, you know how it works. I'm going to feed you a list of titles pulled from John Willis's Screen World Film Manual from 1990. You can comment briefly on each or pass if you wish. And here we go. Julia Roberts in Flatliners.
Honestly, the original Flatliners is not bad. It's pretty, like, it's sexy and weird, and they're all sexy and weird and creepy and hot. So, yeah. Hell yeah.
Angelica Houston was in two great movies in 1990, The Witches and The Grifters.
Love The Grifters. Don't like The Witches.
Whoa. Okay. Alec Baldwin and Jennifer Jason Leigh in Miami Blues.
Pass.
Arnold Schwarzenegger as Kindergarten Cop.
It's darling. It's another, like, if it's on, we're watching it all the time. He's so charming in it.
John Ritter in Problem Child.
So good. So, like, weirdly fucked up in a way that people haven't really reckoned with even now.
I mean, the first big break for Larry Kurzewski and Scott Alexander, so that explains a lot, I think. Christian Slater in Pump Up the Volume.
Oh my God, so good.
Two starring Winona Ryder, Mermaids and Edward Scissorhands.
I love both. I reflect more fondly now on Mermaids as I've grown older.
I watched Mermaids for the first time like a month and a half ago, and it's just lovely. It's just lovely. Another one that was supposed to co-star Winona Ryder, Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather Part 3.
You know, it's The Godfather Part 3. Like, I think we all know how we feel.
John Waters, Crybaby.
Oh my God, I haven't seen Crybaby in forever, but I remember loving it when I was like 15. It was on TBS.
Two from Tom Hanks, the aforementioned Joe versus the Volcano and Brian De Palma's The Bonfire of the Vanities.
Oh, I love both, but Joe versus the Volcano is like a top 10 rom-com for me.
Mike Nichols, Postcards from the Edge.
I haven't watched it in forever, but I remember loving it when I was like 17.
Penny Marshall's Awakenings.
You can't. I'm clutching my chest. Like, that's the appropriate response there.
A film that was advertised with the tagline "Cruise like thunder," Days of Thunder.
Oh my God, Days of Thunder is so great. The two screenwriters, Tom Cruise and Robert Town. What a fucking world.
Catherine Bigelow's Blue Steel.
Pass.
Andrew Bergman's The Freshman.
Another one.
With Marlon Brando and Matthew Broderick.
There's a Komodo dragon.
Yes.
Yes, that's like all I would get. Komodo dragon. Scary.
Mel and Goldie in Bird on a Wire.
Very good. Often forgotten.
Robin Williams as Cadillac Man.
Pass.
Bill Cosby as Ghost Dad.
Pass for different reasons.
Dudley Moore and Daryl Hannah as Crazy People.
Pass, never saw.
Dana Carvey in Opportunity Knocks.
Oh my God, I haven't watched that in forever. I couldn't even form an opinion. Is it good? Is it bad? You tell me.
I mean, I saw it then and I really liked it, but I was 14 and I thought Dana Carvey was just the cat's pajamas. Big year for movies down under. We had both Quigley Down Under and The Rescuers Down Under in 1990.
Never saw Quigley Down Under. Rescuers, obviously, like a childhood staple, a classic.
With the aforementioned John Candy as a voice talent. Have you seen Peter Bogdanovich's Texasville?
I have not seen it, although it was recently playing in my apartment, because Mike watched it a couple weeks ago, and he spoke very highly of it, and he recently interviewed Annie Potts for Ghostbusters, and they mostly talked about Texasville. She thinks it's her best performance, and he agrees.
They're both right, and I love that that's what he spent that interview doing. God bless Mike. The Hudlin Brothers House Party.
You know, haven't seen in years, remembered thinking it was really fun, thought that the remake was sad.
That's quite accurate. Jack Nicholson's The Two Jakes.
I don't have a strong opinion on it. I know other people do. People on my own website have strong opinions. If you want to Google IndieWire, The Two Jakes. Big love to Jim Hemphill. He's a crazy person, but he stands by his opinions.
He is a crazy person. Walter Hill's Another 48 Hours.
Great. I love these films. They're classics to us. We love them.
Another sequel, RoboCop 2.
Not as good as RoboCop, obviously.
Predator 2.
I don't think I can tell my predators apart.
That's the one that's in the city with Danny Glover.
Oh, it's okay. I watched it a couple years ago. It's fine.
It's fine. Rocky 5.
I can't tell my Rockies apart. I know my 1, 2s and 3s, but 4 and 5, that's when I get screwy. Is this like a sad one? It's like the really sad one when he's like a huge... Yeah.
They go broke and he has to go back to the streets.
Yeah.
And,
oh, yeah. They move back to Philly and tragic. No one needs to do that.
They do. And finally, our first listener requested lightning round selection. This one goes out to Jane Lane on Blue Sky. 1990 saw the U.S. release of The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover.
Have not watched it since film 101. So, you know, almost 20 years ago, I remember liking it because I liked all that stuff. But haven't seen it since.
Okay. Outstanding. Well done. That concludes the lightning round. Kate, where can people follow you and find you on social media?
I mean, I guess I'm still on Twitter or X whatever it's called. Yeah. My handle is...
This is the response I guess I'm still on whatever it is now. It's like, flop era, yeah. I gotta say.
I'm still there. I don't know why. I have a Blue Sky account. I have a Threads account. I have an Instagram. It's mainly pictures of birds. I don't know if you're also into birding too, you can follow that. But mostly if you want to find me, just go to IndieWire.com and hopefully you'll see lots of good stuff that you love that I've written or edited or commissioned or something. But that's the mainstay. I'm always there.
I am Fun City Cinema on Instagram, Jason-Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd, where you can find under my list the top fives for every episode of the show, including this one. Mike, where can people find you?
I am at BrainwashedLib on Twitter, where I have gone from abhorring trolls to becoming one, and Fifth Column Films on Blue Sky.
And of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, please do us the huge favor of leaving us a rating and or a review on your podcatcher of choice. Really helps us float to the top of whatever it is over there. Also, want to mention, we do have a newsletter that you can subscribe to and get show notes. That's over at the button down platform. That's buttondown.email/averygoodyear. And you know what? We will put in the piece that Kate mentioned for Vanity Fair, her deep dive into the dark, gritty original version of Pretty Woman, titled, if memory serves, 3000 after the price for the week. Mike, before we go, what is your parting recommendation for 1990?
All right. As it was pointed out, we did 5 movies from the top 20. In fact, 4 movies from the top 10 this week. So I feel...
Gotta go art film student here. Here we go.
As much as I enjoyed all of these movies and talking about them, and God bless Die Hard 2, can we talk about Santa Sangre, or as I like to call it, Jodorowsky's Psycho. Have you seen this movie, this Santa Sangre?
I sure have.
Not my absolute favorite Jodorowsky, but might be the best, like, last 30 minutes of one of movies. It is about a young man whose mother has founded what can really only be described as a religious cult.
Yep.
And the local authorities... maybe their church. There doesn't seem to be a big separation of church and state. Anyway, he's not bothered with defining these things. There are people that don't like her cult, and they shut it down, and she loses her arms and then her son, and then they come back together in more ways than you can possibly imagine. How the fuck would you describe Santa Sangre, bro? I don't even know how to talk about this movie, but it's everything a Jodorowsky movie is supposed to be. Only it's like somehow so much more, because it is about the relationship of a man and his mother through the lens of someone who is... Did he even have a mother? I don't know. Like, I feel like he like sprung fully formed out of a rock and was like the person who invented acid or something. I don't even know. Yeah. All I know is that after you've watched these 5 wonderful, big budget, high grossing films... Go put on Santa Sangre and, like, you know, sit there and think about yourself for a little while.
1990 contained multitudes.
Contained multitudes, and he was making fucking sure of it. How about you, buddy?
Yes. So this was the year that I went to a movie theater and saw Spike Lee's Mo' Better Blues, which was the first Spike movie I ever saw in a theater. I had seen... Do the Right Thing on VHS shortly before then, and it blew my mind. Went back and saw the others, obviously. The thing about Mo' Better Blues is it is not, you know, it is very much considered one of his B-sides. It's not, you know, sort of in the vaunted, you know, the upper echelon of Spike Lee joints. But it's always a film that's been extremely important to me, because I saw this and Goodfellas in fairly close proximity, and they were the first movies that made me extremely keenly aware of a director's voice. Like, those were two movies that I saw where I was both like, oh, I see that a person made this with a style and a sensibility and a love of cinema and a sense of storytelling. The fact that Mo' Better Blues is sort of a throwaway, that it's not about social issues, that it's not historical, that it's him making a jazz movie as the son of a semi-famous jazz composer and performer. So it's steeped in that world. It has an authenticity to it. But also it's just like, it's beautifully shot. It was, you know, this was when he was working with Ernest Dickerson. The color palette of this movie is sumptuous. Ruthie Carter's costumes are gorgeous. Everybody in this movie looks so cool all the time on stage. This is Denzel in like really his first kind of like romantic lead in a major movie. And he's sexy and great. And there's a shot of him playing the trumpet on the Brooklyn Bridge in a suit that is like one of the sexiest images that's ever been in a movie. Wesley Snipes is in it. It's one of the first things I saw him in. Robin Harris was in it. This was a posthumous release for Robin Harris. Spike's sister Joie is in it. Cinda Williams from One False Move is the other sort of part of the romantic triangle. It is a beautiful, affectionate, stylish throwaway, and God bless Spike gets to make throwaways too. So I have a giant spot in my heart for Mo' Better Blues, and I always will. Kate, thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It was so much fun.
Yay. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening.
It was a very good year.